This is KZSU Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. Last week, we aired a show about Amor Mundi, or love of the world. Christina Rossetti once wrote a poem called Amor Mundi. Like St. Augustine, Christina thought love of the world is the easy path. Oh, where are you going with your love locks flowing on the west wind blowing along this valley track? The downhill path is easy, but there's no turning back. I'll go instead with Hannah Arendt, who wrote, "What is most difficult is to love the world as it is. Loving the world means neither uncritical acceptance nor contemptuous rejection, but the unwavering facing up to and comprehension of that which is." I said it before, and I'll say it again, only that kind of love gives the world a future. How deep is our love? Does the world have a collective future? These are some of the questions on tap for us today. Stay tuned, we're letting it roll on Entitled Opinions like there's no tomorrow. Does the world have a collective future? That's a question that asks not so much about the world, but about why so many of us feel that it's on the verge of self-annihilation. That feeling is not uncommon. In the human psyche, the end is always near. The world is always approaching an ultimate threshold. Yet instead of the promised end, all we get are images of that horror, or what we call history. 1,000 years after apocalyptic hysteria swept over Europe toward the end of the first millennium AD, it's still one thing after another after another. I can't go on, I will go on. Or, as the Seafarer poem has it, waneth the watch, but the world holdeth. For those who love the world, that's good news. The world holdeth. For those who loathe the world, no news is good news. What is most difficult is to love the world as it is, and I get the feeling that these days world loathing is getting the better of amor mundi. Yet who knows? We are in the realm of subjective impressions here, and meanwhile, the world holdeth, and meanwhile, Entitled Opinions goes on. I'm joined in the studio today by my good friend and colleague Zep Gumbrecht, the Albert Gerard Professor of Literature Emeritus at Stanford. He's been a frequent guest on Entitled Opinions, and he recently published a thought piece in the German newspaper Die Welt called Asymmetry in the Horizon of the Future, a Serene Diagnosis of the Present. That's my English translation of the title. Zep's article intersects in many ways with the topic of Amor Mundi, so I'm delighted he could join us today to further our discussion about being in the world, and in some cases, being out of the world. Zep, it's been a long time since our last confession. Welcome back to Entitled Opinions.
Thank you, and in a way, it feels like being here again with you is part of Amor Mundi. Now, about this essay that you're quoting, I had the same impression. It has an affinity with your topic and with Hannah Arendt's topic of Amor Mundi, but it is not, and that may be interesting, completely identical. What I really mean by this asymmetry is the following. I'm referring maybe more than to Amor Mundi on the one side to a discourse that's very prevalent today. And that's this discourse of the world coming to an ending. Yeah, I mean, an academic concept that I don't like very much for it is the Anthropocene, which is basically a long present that starts with the first negative impact of human presence on the ecosphere. You can say ever since humans existed, that happens, or you can say since the first industrial revolution, whatever. And there seems to be a certainty in that discourse that within plus minus 50, plus minus 100 years, humankind will come to an ending. There will be no humans on the planet anymore. And what I'm referring to is that to different degrees in different cultural contexts, whenever you make an exception and you say, I'm not happy with this discourse, you produce cynical answers. People don't take you seriously as an intellectual. You cannot be a good intellectual if you don't agree with this discourse. So that's the one side. And of course, I think what is behind this discourse is a waning of Amor Mundi, and that's where we should go. But as I'm talking about an asymmetry, my observation is that strangely, and I have no full explanation for that, we can observe that in the private sphere, personally, individually, people are eager, overly eager, and optimistic about their future. I mean, I give you one banal symptom, and that's individual investments. I mean, if you look on the websites or in still printed daily newspapers today, the sections in the business part where they give personal advice to how you can invest your money, whether that's $100 or $100,000, and not talking of big capital, becomes a big topic. So you can increase your money. That almost becomes a hobby horse. It becomes very, very important. Or, as you mentioned, that I'm a retired professor, I mean, the projects that people have about their private retirement, it is as if life was geared towards retirement. You're retired and then you do philatelia, for example, or you're retired and you start roller skating, or you're retired and start really having sex, which maybe, you know, age-wise is not the right moment. But everybody has very optimistic individual projects about what to do with their life, not only with old life. So that is a strange asymmetry. And perhaps it could be a topic how these two sides interfere. But that's what I'm describing in this essay. And you beautifully translated the subtitle. I don't even know what the German original was. But serenity is an important word there. It's a concept that I like a lot anyway, that maybe one day we can develop here, serenity, in a title sure. Opinions. But what I wanted to say, I'm not trying to describe that with a vested interest. I'm not taking sides. I mean, I'm at first trying to describe what is going on to produce a complexity to which I then can react, hence serenity.
My impression is that you're trying to describe also a mood, a general mood of, let's face it, first world, well-off citizens
yeah.
who can afford early retirement, who can afford to get excited about their investments, and who have the sufficient sort of interconnectivity to realize that there are serious problems facing resource depletion or environmental degradation and so forth. Now, the pessimism of the world future is, on the one hand, a curiosity. In your article, it's the asymmetry of it is that people in their private lives seem to be thriving and very much looking forward to a future. It's when it comes to the collective future that there's this pessimism. So my first question now in terms of substance is how much of your diagnosis, serene diagnosis, is restricted to the first world and to a first world bourgeoisie, which is actually very well off and has the luxury to contribute significantly to the environmental degradation of the planet as a whole because they have the means for more consumption, more airline miles, more refrigeration, and all these things. How much of your diagnosis would apply to countries outside of this privileged sphere?
Yeah, I mean, that's, of course, an obligatory and a good question, but I will hold to a certain degree against it. I mean, one degree would be to say, you know, this is the type of analysis and essay that you can, in the phenomenological tradition, only do about the world of which you are part.
Of course, yes.
About the world which you inhabit. So, you know, it's difficult for me, and I wouldn't feel entitled.
Okay, so Zep, let me then ask a question that goes more into the kind of nuance that you will appreciate. Our world and this kind of pessimism of the collective future, is there, in your opinion, a kind of subterranean guilt on the part of a European bourgeoisie about the degree to which their privileges are a problem?
No, I don't think so. And maybe unfortunately, but my observation is that people embrace this pessimism individually again, because it entitles them to claim an individual possession of exception. Yeah, I mean, you are aware of the problem, and because you are aware of the problem, you can talk from a position of condescension. Yeah, I mean, yes, I can see the problem, but nobody else can see the problem. To give you an example, I think the country I'm relatively familiar with, because for some years I've been teaching there now for 5 weeks per year, so I have a certain familiarity with the everydayness, where this is the most extreme, is Israel. Now, if you take this impression from an Israeli point of view, there's no future. You apply it to Israel, but you always then take the position of those who are friends with the Palestinians, of those who are not privileged, of those who are the political exception. So I would say, individually speaking, that pessimism is a basis, a background against which you can claim a superior level of ethics. I mean, ethics today, in an extreme way, is the most frequently used concept in everyday German. Everybody claims that she or he ethically is superior against the background of this pessimism. All the others are not ethically responsible. But it is strangely, and this is my criticism, not so serene criticism, against the background of people of your own class and against the background, in that sense, it's hypocrite, of your own behavior.
Right. Well, I'm with you there on, I don't know if I'm going to call it hypocrisy, but I would call it mauvaise foi.
Yeah, no, much better. Yeah.
In the Sartrean sense of...
Second chapter.
Yeah, it's a self-deception where I can see the problem. I recycle my trash.
Yes.
The world is going to hell, but, you know, I am not the problem. The problem is with the world. You actually are the problem. Because if you universalize, I've said this before on Entitled Opinions, if you take Kant's categorical imperative and you materialize it and say, what would happen to the world if everyone behaved the way I do? Or what would happen to the world if everyone consumed the amount of energy that I consume every year? Well, the Earth's carrying capacity would be so overwhelmed that it would not be possible. So the typical first world citizen cannot universalize his standard of living. So this is what Rocantin called les salauds. Salauds who believe that the world is a problem, that they're not the problem. In other words, they believe that they are not part of the world, but they are part of the world.
I mean, so we have this analysis, and this is how my essay intersects with what you're saying about Amor Mundi. But of course, what I find interesting about the way in which specifically Hannah Arendt is using that concept is perhaps in my reading that this Amor Mundi is not deep, as you were saying, as she's saying, deep in the intellectual sense. Yeah, I think there is a very basic positive relationship to the material world that surrounds us, to the social world that surrounds us, maybe a desire that's pre-predicative. I mean, a desire that does not yet have concepts. And this is what I think is bracketed. And this is what I think allows this pessimism, this sophisticated pessimism, this, you're right, this mauvaise foi pessimism of the salaud, to be so prevalent. Yeah, I mean, there is something elementary that seems to be lost and that perhaps it is difficult to resuscitate in an intellectual way. I mean, that's what you and people like you and I can do, to analyze it intellectually. But this very elementary, this very naive drive and desire of the world underlying Amor Mundi is what fascinates me most about it, and what I think is really lacking, and what I would like to resuscitate if I could.
Yeah, Amor Mundi, sometimes there's misunderstandings that the mundus, the world, I mean it, I think Hannah Arendt means it, and St. Augustine meant it as the world that is made by humans for humans, and is really the public sphere. It's not the private sphere. And that means it's the political. You're right. There are all these different loves. You can have the love of the society that surrounds you. You can love your animals. You can love your future. whether we can love the political world is the real challenge. And it's difficult, let's face it. Hannah Arendt said it is what is most difficult, because you look at policies and so forth, and you know, an ordinary citizen who doesn't have to be a salaud can get quite frustrated at a certain level of dysfunctionality in the political sphere. And yet, I think it's still dangerous to just surrender, renounce any such love of the political. That doesn't mean that I'm calling for activism, because really there's also nothing that is more close to the mauvaise foi we're analyzing than the illusion that if I Twitter every other day about how awful Donald Trump is, then I'm being politically active and doing something good in the public sphere. No, that's not how the Amor Mundi works.
Absolutely. Now, just before we go into this analysis, what we can do about the public sphere, and I agree that is the topic that we can talk about, let me take one step back to this elementary Amor Mundi. And I thought I'd give you as an example. I mean, I have four grandchildren, and I'm saying something that a grandfather should never say. So far, my favorite among the four is 2 years and 2 months old, and that's Olive. And I identify a lot with her, not because she's very cute, because how could I identify with that, but I identify a lot with her because she likes things. She likes words, for example. So there was one day where she speaks really well, when she was experimentally starting every sentence. She can speak full sentences, which is quite unusual at her age, with unfortunately. She liked the word unfortunately, and she was making nonsense sentences with unfortunately, but she liked the word unfortunately. Or, you know, I was sitting at home and I was Skyping and talking to somebody in Brazil, and proud that I can pronounce and speak Brazilian Portuguese with a Rio accent. And all of a sudden she was fascinated and loved these words. You know, there's something primary. Or when she's having lunch, I mean, she spends 2 days per week at our house. She likes new foods. She just likes them. She touches them. So this very elementary and very immediate Amor Mundi is something that I think and I fear that in the process of education and almost necessarily we lose, and we teach people to lose, and it is very much in the good sense of the Kantian imperative. Right. Yeah. So if you reach a certain degree of abstraction, which in order to have a public sphere, in order to have morality, you have to, you're losing this immediacy that I'm still seeing in this 2-year-old girl. Yeah, I mean, there is something that is very difficult to preserve, but something, and that was why I would like to mention that, we should try to preserve as much as we can as an instinct, as a very elementary basis of Amor Mundi.
Good, good. So in our conversations before coming on air, you know, the Amor Mundi show, you mentioned in reference, I think, to the Vico passage that I cited, that you know, man begins by loving himself and his own utility. Then he gets married and loves his own utility, that of his family, and then of his tribe, and then of his city, then of the nation. And then finally, when the whole world is united by treaties and commerce, etc., he loves his own utility plus the welfare of the entire world and the entire human race. And I mentioned in the monologue that can Amor Mundi actually exceed a certain limit, spatial, cultural units? And you also seem to believe that it might be unrealistic to expect that an Amor Mundi can actually go beyond quite limited, delimited spheres of immediacy.
Yeah, see, that now we are entering what I think is the true political problem there. A certain degree of, I mean, you know, if one can use that word, global frustration or frustration with parliamentary democracy. Let me just say, I mean, one of us has to make the sentence that, you know, quoting Churchill or whomever you want to quote, I mean, it may be political form, a form of political institution with many problems, but we certainly do not know a better alternative. So I do think it is worth trying to conserve that by any means. But given the fact that it is based on 18th century philosophy, and basically not by quoting, but based on the imperative, the Kantian imperative that you were quoting, it has an inherent problem that it will always extend to universality. Yeah. And to paradoxically refer to an American phenomenon, I fear that the success that Donald Trump had at a certain moment in this country was precisely because, perhaps without knowing it, without any cynicism, he produced an impression that there was an immediacy, that there was a presence in the contact with him that other politicians would not convey. I'm not saying he did that. I'm not saying that he's the solution. But the symptom is interesting. There was an impression of immediacy that he and some other politicians, and maybe right-wing politicians, are producing that is not inherent to that system of parliamentary democracy. And I think that should be a focus maybe of our discussion, but certainly a focus of political thought. What is the scale? How far can we go before we lose this impression of immediacy?
Right. Well, in fact, I think you're describing also the kind of immediacy, but love that he was able to inspire among his most devoted followers.
Yeah.
And whether parliamentary EU-style democracy, whether it just does, even though it might be the most rational system of government, and in the long run, it will produce the greatest good for the greatest number, but it's very difficult with such a dispassionate technocratic machinery to get people to commit themselves with that deep love which is instinctive in all of us, no?
Yeah, if you allow me for an almost autobiographical narrative, but it is at least about Bildung, I mean, about culture, about erudition. I mean, so the first foreign language that I learned at the gymnasium at the high school with 10 years was Latin. And of course, you know, in this democratic and post-World War II Germany, everything had to be practical. So it was not very evident why I would have to learn Latin. And I can still remember my Latin teacher told me, because one day the Roman Republic, he said, the Roman Republic, speaking Latin, can be an example for a new unified Europe. This was long before there were any EU projects. And then, yes, it changed my motivation, and I was focusing on the Roman Republic, and all of a sudden I liked Latin. It was something concrete, and I had a love, I mean, not an amor mundi, for this historical example. And then, indeed, you know, it was still during my high school years, the European Economic Union, and then the European Union came all about. And the disappointing story is that while this is a beautiful normative idea and an idea that in the extension of enlightenment makes a lot of sense until the present day to denationalize, it has never really ignited, it has never really inspired any function. I mean, the elections to the European Parliament had always a very low participation. The coverage of the European Parliament was not interesting. And while it has produced many positive effects for the European citizens, it has always remained an abstract idea that has never been able to inspire, to ignite that love. And I'm now using a much maligned concept that nationhood has produced during the 19th century and even during the early 20th century in a very problematic way. But nevertheless, there was an intensity that the EU has never had.
Absolutely. And here, when you talk about that abstract quality, you know, my brother Tom wrote recently his book on bridges.
Yes.
And we had a show on bridges.
Beautiful book.
Yeah. He pointed out that if you look at the euro, all the bills have bridges on them. Well, that's fine. You're bridging different nations and so on. But I pointed out that I think the euro is the only currency known to me which does not have any faces on it. And these, you know, this is a big difference between a personification of a nation or a, you know, a people with certain figures. It's almost like in the Catholic tradition, you know, you have saints. You can relate to saints. You can't relate to God very easily because he's very abstract. He's very remote. But the saints are these personifications of the good, of the holy, of the transcendental. The European currency has no faces on them. And I think that is related to what you're talking about as something that it can't inspire the same sort of growth.
I hate to correct you, and I'm not correcting you, but I will make your point by correcting you, okay? I mean, the coins, actually, or at least the 2 euro coin, I'm certain about the 2 euro coin, has faces. And it has national faces.
Right, I meant the Bills, yes.
I give you a good example. There is, for example, the face of the Belgian king on 2 euro coins that you're using in Spain or in Portugal or in Germany. Now, for the Belgians, that might be nice. There is even, you will not know, the face of a former colleague of ours at Stanford, Karl Cherassi, on one of the Austrian versions. But the problem is that while you and I have memories of Karl Cherassi, and that may produce positive or negative, I mean, he was, so to speak, the inventor of the birth control pill for our listeners, and an interesting colleague at Stanford, whether you liked him or not. This produces memories for us, but somebody using a 2 euro coin in Portugal with the face of Karl Cherassi has no reference of it. And in that sense, what you were saying about the EU bills, even with the faces, it doesn't help, because these faces have no local context. And that, in that sense, a currency circulating with national faces in this EU space is precisely the concretization, almost like an allegory of the paradox or the problem we want to point to.
All right. So I gather that you believe that Amor Mundi, beyond a political entity such as the nation, might be very problematic and unlikely. But I want to go back in this vein to what you were saying about Donald Trump. Did Donald Trump, in his appeal and inspiration of the kind of devotion, in some cases fanatical devotion of his followers, did he also expose the fact that perhaps America is too big a nation, or that it's not one nation, that it's maybe two different nations, at least in the sense that a civil war never really came to an end? It kind of just calmed down, it simmers, but that it can always erupt at any moment, and that he was making his appeal to a kind of America that is smaller, you know, in scale and in size, which has much stronger cultural delimitation and mentality, and that it's not inclusive of all the 50 states. It's, you know what I'm getting at.
I completely know where you're getting. I mean, I think it makes a statement necessary, not for the typical political logic that you have to be of the left or whatever, anti-Republican party, when you are a humanities intellectual, but for aesthetic reasons that have to do much with his looks, actually. You know, when I see a photograph of Donald Trump, I've never had a sympathy for him. Now,
yeah, it's hard to know how he elicits that much
love.
Yeah,
I mean, I would even not exclude that in this very, I mean, just not exclude, this is now on the other side, that in this very elementary sense in which I was referring to my granddaughter, he has something like an Amor Mundi. I mean, this is not just, I mean, you know, people were saying, oh, he was fascinated by power. I would actually think, to give you another example of the left, I mean, the Brazilian president Lula, whether you like him or not, is a typical politician who's fascinated by power. He wants to have power. I think Donald Trump is more fascinated by people listening to him. Yeah, by people listening to him, and people listen to him. That could even be people of the other party that would be good for him. So there is an immediacy that seems to drive him. Yeah,
you're absolutely right. There's not a craving for power, very exceptional. It's a craving for attention.
Neither power nor economy. I think, you know, he hasn't made much money by being a president. He hasn't used this opportunity. So there is a craving for attention, but a craving for attention means that you, I mean, again, my granddaughter shares that, you know, when she realized that Ricky, my wife, and I were fascinated by using unfortunately all the time of the beginning of her little sentences, she was doing more unfortunately because she wanted more attention. So there is something to it that is not cynical. Now, and in that sense, and just to again prove your point, the fact that in the re-election campaign that he, as far as I'm concerned, fortunately lost, he just bracketed California. He didn't go to California. One reason, of course, was that was his political advisors. He knew that he couldn't win California anyway, so why going? But secondly, because he knew that in California, he would not have that craving that perhaps he would have in South Dakota, that he would have, you know, with the white former proletariat in states like Pennsylvania, et cetera, et cetera. In that sense, I think he kind of conjured up almost an American community That doesn't include all the 330 million Americans, but that created a surprising community because, as a colleague of ours once said to me, and that is right, on the classical political map, Trump is not just of the right. Yeah? He is of the people who fulfill this craving for him. And that is a very strange and a very mixed group of the population. But it is, I think, a group of the population, not typically Republican voters. That's not what they are. It's a group of the population who has a craving, as Trump has a craving for their attention, they have a craving for immediacy. And this craving for immediacy is what the present-day form of politics, not only in the U.S., but in the U.S. and also in the EU, is not fulfilling, is not responding to.
Craving for immediacy, but as well as a certain ressentiment, a profound grievance that also motivates. It's not just all about love. It's also about hate. So, and hate is a passion. So it does enter into the sphere of amor mundi because passions are what amor in the larger sense really encompasses.
I agree with you. And we could actually say now, being more self-critical, that a discourse that has been breeded in and is still breeding in the academy, the politically correct discourse, is above all a discourse that doesn't allow you to hate. Yeah, and I think this absolute prohibition of the passion of hatred, of the passion of disliking something, the passion of disliking even people. Yeah, I mean, this law of universal inclusion is problematic in that sense. So craving for immediacy is not only positive, but perhaps we are at a point where we would be as an interesting reformulation of the Arendt concept of amor mundi. I mean, that amor mundi is relation of immediacy to the social sphere, but also to the material world that is surrounding us, that is not only on the positive side.
There's one other motif in the Amor Mundi monologue that you mentioned, which was lamplight love. Let me remind listeners or those who haven't heard that monologue that I coined this term, lamplight love, which comes from a W.B. Yeats poem where the line is, "How can they know who have no solitude that truth flourishes where the student's lamp has shone and they're alone?" And I spoke about the kind of love that the student, not just institutional student, but any reader who withdraws from the world and brings to the page a mental concentration and a certain kind of light of attention to what is being read, that this lamplight love is also foundational for the world. It is where our knowledge ultimately springs from. It's where our communication, you know, through publication, it's where our historical memory, cultural memory comes from. And so we owe a great deal to this lamplight love. And you said something very curious I'd like you to expand on, and that's that you don't feel yourself very much of that lamplight love. It's not, it's a form of reading or a close reading that you don't necessarily sympathize with a lot, right? Did I get you right? Or
yes, you got me right. I mean, I was just wondering how I should react to it. I mean, I think it is, on the one hand, it is, and my reaction to your lamplight love was a reaction in that sense. It's a reaction to a certain mythology, to a certain aura that the concept of reading, capital R, has not only in the American Academy, but in America in general. Yeah, I mean, people go to their reading groups, and I mean, reading is always surrounded by this aura. And if you're not a good reader and not a dedicated reader, you can almost not be part of a respectful or respected society. And I have had a certain reaction against that because I mean, retired 4.5 years ago because I wanted to have time for what intellectually fascinates me the most. I mean, this is probably an amor mundi, but I will have to admit, sounds very egocentric. What fascinates me the most is writing, and not writing in an easy way, but writing and working on projects where when I'm beginning, I don't know yet where it is going, you know, where I have a complexity for which I have to find a form. And in that sense, I feel, if I'm honest, that my reading is always more related to this desire to bring things together, to produce complexity, and ultimately to write a book or to give a lecture, but ultimately to have a moment where I manage to give a form to this complexity. But the moment that you're describing, yeah, the moment in the literal sense, the moment of this lamp attention moment, that is a moment that I have in my life. I mean, as you know, I get up very early, between 2 and 3 a.m. normally, because I like this morning in the dark, and I have a lamp over my desk at home, and then I'm focused. But I'm not necessarily focused on the reading. I oftentimes don't end up the reading as soon as I get a good idea. So, you know, last week I was reading the chapter on conscience, on Gewissen, in Heidegger's Being and Time, and where he has the thesis that the conscience doesn't talk to us. Conscience is only this call. And then all of a sudden, he has a strange word that I will immediately translate. He says the important thing about the call of conscience is its directedness, its address. It's an address. It hits you at a certain moment, and you know, without any doubt, it means you. And when in the focus of my lamplight, I had this word and this idea, I stopped reading the chapter, and I was writing down notes, and I was beginning to imagine a chapter in a book on conscience. You get my point? I mean,
no, I get the point. But for me, that's lamplight love.
Okay.
That is exactly the way in which a certain state of mental concentration, of which reading is only a part, but then the taking of what, the hearing of what you have read, because it's strange that you use that example. I think that any even short moments of concentrated reading, you feel addressed by what you're
beautiful. Reading. Then we completely agree, but yeah. We have a different concept. I mean, I oftentimes don't finish books, and not because I don't think they're great, but all of a sudden, like what I was saying with this chapter, I have this moment, right. And I have to embrace this moment, and I have to do something with this moment. And in that sense, yes, I'm a passionate reader, but I'm not a passionate reader who feels obliged to finish every chapter, to finish every book that I'm reading.
Well, you know, Zep, I refer to the Vita Nuova in my monologue, where that whole lamplight love, where Dante says, "Io studio quanto posso." And the strange thing there is that he's written this book, and he didn't get to the end, but he says, "I'm going to leave this book unfinished, because I want to learn how to say about Beatrice what has never been said of any woman, and I need to study a lot more before I do it." So he doesn't even have to finish writing his book, because his love of knowledge, his love of study, is going to take him elsewhere. So all that's very good, but I also want to remind a lot of the listeners of Entitled Opinions are aware that you and I ran a group for many years called the Philosophical Reading Group, and there we actually did meet every week on Thursday evenings and paid actual close attention to some of these works. Anyway, that's...
But that was a good example, because we had a weekly assignment. We had a weekly assignment, 10 pages, 20 pages, out of great works, classical works of philosophy more than contemporary works. And I have to say, the way that I remember the Philosophical Reading Group is much more segmented in this way. I mean, you could say that we had a time when we say 2 out of 3 sessions are really very good, astonishingly good. I mean, these were not classes that we were giving, and we were facilitating it, but where all of a sudden there is a focus that is enormous and that's not predictable. So they were lamplight moments in that moment.
Well, yeah, and the interesting thing is oftentimes what was revealed in the hour and a half discussion is the intimacy that each individual in the room had brought to the reading, and it was very diverse, and each one was coming from his or her own lamp into this larger light of, you know, of a group, and it was, anyway, that's where we...
But, I mean, if I can pick up this idea, this memory that we both have, I mean, that was a size, for those who have never participated. It was, depending on the reading that we had, I would say normally between 20 and 40 people. And there were normally, I mean, there was no obligation to participate. It was not a seminar. We didn't get grades. You could be there. There was only obsession. If you come to the second session, you make it till the end of the quarter. You come every week. And what I think, this was a format, and this also was a size that we have lost for politics. Yeah, there was no goal beyond that. The goal was to do philosophy in that group. And I think by coming there, you showed that it mattered to you. And this cohesion and this concentration and this passion, really, because people went there because they had a passion for doing philosophy, whether they were speaking or not. That is a scale and that is an intensity that we seem to have largely lost in present-day parliamentary democracy. And, this
and
is
often in the classrooms.
In the classrooms, yeah. As a reflex of that, yeah.
We've been speaking with my good friend Zep Gumbrecht, professor emeritus at Stanford. Zep, you are writing a book on voice.
On voice, yeah.
I can't wait for it to be finished, not only to read it, but to also discuss it with you. And I've gotten, you know, a lot of previews about it. And even on the way here, you were telling me about the section you're working on in terms of the voice of the Hebrew God versus New Testament.
The voice
voices,
of Jesus. Yeah,
the voice of Jesus and so forth. It all sounds very, very compelling. So
I have a question for our listeners. If there's anybody who has any passage from the Gospel or from the Act of the Apostles where the voice of Jesus is described by more than the adjective loud. The only passage that I've found is the adjective loud, and this is in its last words, when he loudly says, my God, why have you forsaken me? But this is the only specific description, which is very strange.
That is strange, because one gets a sense of an image of Jesus that he would be a quiet, kind of soft-spoken guy. But
that's what I always thought.
Yeah. Thanks again, Zep.
Thank you, Robert.
We've been speaking with Zep Gumbrecht here on Entitled Opinions. I'm Robert Harrison. Thanks for listening.
What a sight for my eyes to see you in sleep. Could it stop the sunrise hearing you weep? You're not seen, you're not heard, but I stand. A thousand miles just to catch you while you're smiling. What a day for laughter and walking at night. Me following after your hand holding tight. And the memory stays clear with a song that you hear. If I can but make the words awake.